then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's October the 17th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. I'm going to begin here with a quick comment on my adventurous first encounter with Obamacare. I finally checked out the official Washington State Obamacare site, if only to see if I could get the answer, finally, to the great mysterious question of how much this crap is going to cost me if I buy it. Now, that's the one thing that the Democrats have kept completely close to the vest for the past 3 years. How much is it going to cost, especially for a white man my age with pre-existing conditions? Well, I still don't know, because I had no luck getting into the website. I went to wahealthplanfinder.com at 7 p.m. on a Sunday night, 2 weeks after the site went live. The Democrats have since claimed that the problems on the websites were caused by millions of eager Americans rushing to sign up for Obamacare. But I rather doubt there were millions of Washingtonians jamming the lines trying to sign on at that time and date. The site wouldn't let me in. It wouldn't even let me create an account. You know the place on every site registration where you have to type in your password twice? It kept telling me my passwords didn't match. Now, for some reason, these morons demand that each password be 8 to 20 characters long and contain one capital letter, one lowercase letter, and one of four special symbols which they specify. My password complied with these conditions. I attempted to set up an account 4 times, and I'll give them this, at least they didn't blow away all my other info when I failed. I typed the password into both fields carefully, slowly, and meticulously. Those passwords matched, but the site kept kicking it out and saying that they didn't. I'll try again in a couple of weeks and see if the Democrats and their third world IT team of illegals and niggers have gotten it right yet. And then I might finally get an answer to my question. How much do these fools seriously think I am going to pay for this so niggers and Mexicans and illegal aliens can get free health care? Question. Now, if I can't get into the website at all between now and tax time next year, which kind of looks likely, and if I attach a letter to that effect to my 2013 income tax return, is the IRS still going to hit me with a fine? Of course they will. Like that little black girl at the Washington Medicaid office told me many years ago, my demographic is supposed to be paying for these benefits, not drawing on them. Now, here's a suggestion. Why don't all of you send me in your own personal Obamacare stories? Preferably in the form of an MP3 file so we can hear your voice. But let's hear how it's going out there for all you white folks. The sky-high premiums, the non-functional websites, the loss of your doctor, loss of your health care that you had with your company, so forth and so on. If you can send those to me in MP3 form, I'll see if I can get them up over the next couple of weeks here on the show.
Thank you. evening, comrades. Tonight I'd like to talk about something that I've heard on this show a lot, and that is the comment or the opinion that we have to do something on this show or in this movement to quote-unquote cater to Americans. My thought on this topic is that we're really not catering to Americans. We're catering to independent-minded white people who are free thinkers. These individuals may live in America or they may live elsewhere, but the important thing about these individuals is that they have had a secession of the mind. They've divorced themselves from ordinary society, and they're looking for some sort of an alternative within the white movement. And maybe they've been involved in other organizations, and maybe they have not. But in any case, they've probably looked into other organizations and realized that these organizations, while they may have websites and manifestos and meetings, that these organizations are not likely to go anywhere. And so they're looking for an alternative, and they come to the Northwest Front, presumably because it is different. And for that reason, I think we should be leery of making ourselves the same as other organizations. We know those other organizations really are never going to come to anything in the real world. So those are just my thoughts. I think that we are looking for individuals who really have mentally detached themselves from any kind of label of being quote-unquote American or being perhaps some other nationality, and they're realizing that there has to be this territorial imperative, and they realize that, first of all, they need to make themselves into, I almost want to say, something new or something different from the average person that you see walking around. That's one way to put it. I'm not sure how clear that is, but they have to transform themselves into somebody who belongs to this new nation in their minds before it actually becomes a thing in the real world. And I think that's the kind of person we're looking for. Now, I don't know how many of those there are, but that's what we have to cultivate. So we don't need to find Americans so much as we need to find these individuals who have divorced themselves from ordinary society and who are willing to entertain the idea of something different. I've often had these thoughts, but I've never expressed them because they just seem so obvious. But I thought I would share these rather apparent thoughts, but they're thoughts that have never been explicitly, or they have been somewhat on this show. They have been mentioned somewhat, but I just thought I would put out that sort of realization for you. So thank you for listening.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. Since Mr. Covington announced his series of talks on the draft Northwest American Republic Constitution, I've seen a number of good questions about the proposals it contains, and I'm especially qualified to answer one of them in particular. I hope many of you find this helpful, instructive, or even edifying. Those of you who have read the document, which is available at the party website, will have come across a clause, Section 5, Article 6, which states, "No citizen or resident of the Northwest American Republic may accept any monetary emolument, fee, gift, or anything of value for performing the function of a priest or minister of religion." There's a similar clause, Article 7 of the same section, which prohibits remuneration for providing legal services, and that one doesn't seem to draw any concern. I can understand why the religious clause isn't so well accepted, and that's what I'm going to address today. The true reasoning behind both of these clauses is that the community as a whole has a duty not to put up with these two parasitic and useless groups. You'll note Section 5 of the draft Constitution is the Bill of Responsibilities because it lists things which individuals must do and which they must not do. I don't think it's disputable, especially in Zog America, that a largely useless priest class, which possesses nearly all of their waking hours to do with as they wish, will become greatly troublesome to the entire state very quickly. Idle hands on all that. These people tend to get themselves involved in every little thing since they've got nothing better to do. Religious devotees will take everything their ministers say at face value well over 9 times out of 10. Once someone's been told something by their minister of choice, or whatever person occupying whatever position of religious authority they subscribe to, odds are they're sold on that way of thinking for the rest of their life. Now, I'm sure some newer people out there are screaming at their iPods, or whatever they're listening on, that I'm some sort of anti-religious crusader who is just out to shut them down personally, or perhaps to ban their particular belief. No, I'm not. Quite the opposite, in fact. Try rereading The Hill of the Ravens if you don't understand what sort of society we're shooting for. Your objections notwithstanding, the reason behind the ban on paid religious workers really is because of what they're capable of. And no, we're not going to ruin your religion just because you don't have a full-time pastor, or priest, or any type of clergy around to do religious work for you. Here's why. From the earliest part of my childhood well into my adult life, I attended nothing but your standard, garden-variety American evangelical churches. Most, but not all, were Baptist of one kind or another. Every single one of them, without fail, were totally and completely Zionist in their outlook, which means that's how I was raised. I understand very well the dangers associated with political preaching, especially the stuff that comes across as particularly spiritual. The Constitution's prohibition of someone being paid to do this sort of thing is quite necessary, and I understood this from the moment I found the party. But having been raised in a religious environment, I was very conflicted about this particular clause in the draft document, but I found a way to reconcile it based on my own experience. How much is this really going to inhibit religious practice in the Republic? None at all, actually. Here's the thing you need to grasp. Most pastors of small churches have a side gig they need for benefits and the bulk of their pay. I've already said these churches were Zionist, but bear with me here. Some of them were better from various perspectives, Zionism notwithstanding. Out of the churches I attended, the two which were perhaps the healthiest from a moral and religious perspective, again, despite the Zionism, were quite small, and their pastors held various jobs outside the church to keep their families going. It wasn't until a church got to a few hundred people attending that they could manage to keep up all their financial obligations to the point where the clergy didn't have outside employment. Last time I checked, a very small percentage of churches across America are actually this large or larger. The practical effects of this sort of financial arrangement must be observed to understand just what sort of role a paid minister plays in the church he pastors. That role is, oddly enough, nothing at all. The deal is this, guys. In every church I went to, the pastor didn't really do a whole lot, and perhaps the most honest pastor I ever had flat out admitted that anyone who wants to can be a pastor. Most of these people are just looking for a very low-effort job where the people who pay them are going to fawn over them for acting a certain way. And that's largely what they get. Very few pastors will take the time to run around and do the sorts of things the Christian Bible says a pastor ought to do. Most of the time, the socially beneficial day-to-day duties of a church were passed out to those whom the pastor thought could handle them. In fact, most leadership of every church is totally unpaid, and they conduct their church business in their off hours. Even when that business required the presence of the pastor, it was not during normal hours, and there wasn't any reason the pastor needed to be paid for his attendance. The only churches which would be affected by this at all are those huge megachurches you hear about in the news for one reason or another. I even attended one of these churches for about a year, and the only reason they were popular is that their pastors had enough money to run around and act like celebrities. So the only real loss in the NAR to this type of religious setup is that there will be no professional celebrity pastors. No, really, that's it. Those who are actually pious will pick up whatever duties their pastors can no longer perform, few though they are, and the truly devout are capable of doing their own religious study, so they can assist others when the pastor can't. Further, none of this is limited to one variety of Christianity or even all of Christianity. Other faiths which demand things of their adherents operate this way out of habit, and you'll notice they're just fine. In fact, you'll notice they're quite a bit better off. When people stop using their faiths as some sort of country club, those who aren't really interested will wander off. Everyone left has some sort of actual interest and can therefore do the things they say their faith is meant to do. The only actual loss would be to the ultra-rich mega-congregations, and truly, very few people attend these churches. Ultimately, any faith community is going to be better off since they're only going to have time to get involved in their own business, and not the politics of their celebrity preacher of choice. My discussion today has been totally focused on an evangelical Christian arrangement, but it holds true for all types of faiths, including the non-Christian ones. Very early in Freedom Sons, which is now fully published and available for purchase, the issue of what older Christian traditions could do to mitigate this particular problem is dealt with quite nicely. As I said, other faiths would do well to observe what I've pointed out, but I suspect they've already learned how to handle themselves quite nicely. I really hope everyone can get on the same page of this thing for once. I realize not everyone likes every aspect of the draft constitution. That's totally fine, but please remember a few things. Firstly, it's not up for rewrite since we've got something more important to take care of. Secondly, it's a draft. The people who win the revolution are going to have to come up with the actual implementation of government in the Republic. Thirdly, those responsible for its contents have tried to solve a very hard problem which no one has the permanent solution to. For obvious reasons, it's not democratic in nature, and it can be. But how do we allow superior individuals to control society while permitting their inferior descendants to assume their proper status with the rest of society? Fascism is amazing in terms of political doctrines, but we need to come up with something which is going to operate in the real world. And no, that doesn't mean ruling out fascism, but it does mean taking notice of something very important. There have been quite a few attempts at this in the past, and to date, none of them has panned out. I suspect that our race is going to work at this Aryan government thing for quite some time to come. The party has taken grief from all quarters about everything we do, and it's usually because we did a little too much of something or not enough of another. This has always taken the guise of a claim that we're somehow going off the deep end because we didn't cater to a person's particular pet peeve. I'm honestly not trying to step on someone's toes here, but I've absolutely got to take notice of a repeated occurrence. I'm actually surprised we haven't been hassled about the draft constitution as of late, since I'm sure a number of new listeners haven't taken the time to explore it. I'll close with a reminder. There are all sorts of documents on the party website other than the draft constitution of the Northwest American Republic. It's really worth your time to understand how the Northwest Front proposes to implement the 14 words of David Lane by reading them all and picking up at least one of the Northwest Independence novels. I suggest The Brigade. Hail victory, comrades.
We have a guy on our list who has a real talent for digging up little bits and pieces of audio footage all over the internet relating to the history and heritage of our movement. This is a song that he dug up from 1906. Hell, it probably wasn't even a record originally. It was probably one of those wax cylinders that the oldest Victrolas used to play. This is from a ragtime comic team called Collins and Harlan, specifically Arthur Collins and Byron Harlan, who did the vaudeville circuit between 1903 and 1926. This one's called Nigger Loves His Possum, and it's another illustration of the fact that we are not freaks or weirdos of any kind. 100 years ago, everybody thought like we do.
Memphis and get a new one.
Look here, Master Captain. That hat cost me 4 bits. Now ain't that desperating?
Nigga loves the possum sizzling in the pan. Nigga loves the corn juice feeling in the can. Ain't the use of talking, nigga through and through. Loves his watermelon, dee doo doo doo. Oh, don't you hear her grunt and growl?
off the furnace, Lordy, how she grin. When she eats that wood up and an awful grin, leave the little treason, kept a nigger in. Oh, nigger loves the parson, sizzling in the pan. Nigger loves the corn, you steal it if he can. Ain't the use to talk him, nigger through and through. Well, a nigger loves the pot and sizzling in the pan. Nigger loves the corn to steal it if he can. Ain't the use to talk him, nigger do and do. Loves the watermelon, dee-dee-doo-doo-doo.
Right, let's leap back into constitutional matters for a bit. I got a couple of questions from a comrade in England. Now, a word in your shell-like ears. A lot of the comments I've received about this seem to reflect what appears more and more to me to be a predominant white desire to be micromanaged and have everything spelled out down to the last detail, even when there is no way we really can know the last detail. Now, bear in mind that we can't know many of these things. They haven't happened yet. Yeah, I can speculate on how certain things might happen, but I prefer to do that in my novels, which are supposed to be fiction. I'm not criticizing, so please, no hysterical sobbing and running off into a cyber corner to sulk, okay? Just making an observation. This obsession with minor detail and this longing to be micromanaged seems to be one of our racial characteristics that white boys have developed or fallen into over the past couple of generations. Our hands must be held and we must be gently walked through every step. We don't seem to be able to do big picture or broad strokes anymore in the past few decades. Again, I'm not talking about anybody in particular here, okay? I'm simply making an observation. This is something that seems to be happening to us and we need to be aware of it. Okay, question one from our British comrade. Who gets to decide who has achieved enough to be promoted from citizenship third class to citizenship first class? Well, I don't know. What did the Constitution say about that? If it didn't say anything, my own personal view is that it will probably be decided under parameters and requirements laid out by the Citizenship Committee of the National Convention. That's what those parliamentary committees are for. And administered possibly by the Bureau of Race and Resettlement or some other government authority. Maybe a citizenship office or something. But that's just me. Now that is one of the many, many topics that will have to be settled after we have displayed physical courage and broke brave and won the right to decide it. Breaking brave. I like that term. Question two from our London friend. Will civil law as opposed to criminal law be abolished in the Northwest American Republic? If so, does that mean that contract violations would constitute a criminal offense? Does this mean the return of debtors' prisons? I don't know where you got debtors' prisons from out of that there, comrade, but this is actually a pretty good question, the whole issue of civil law in the Republic. I think there are some guiding principles in the 2006 draft, but I can give you my own opinion based on many years of personal experience. Now, the simplest cop-out for me would be to say that there would be no difference between civil law and criminal law in practice. No district or superior courts, just one county judge or one of multiple county judges depending on the size of the county. And my reading of the Constitution is that this would be true. Now, remember, in the NAR, there is no judicial branch of government, and courts exist purely to investigate, try, and determine issues of fact. And to a much lesser extent, issues of law immediately applicable to a particular case. Now, since Northwest judges will not be busying themselves rewriting the Constitution, they will have more time to do their real jobs. As far as lawsuits and debts and whatnot go, those procedures will be laid out in the statute book, which, as I said in several of the novels, should consist, if at all possible, of one single volume. Possibly with a constitutional limit on the word length, so that when the law book breaks 100,000 words or whatever the limit is, the convention must then repeal some laws to make room for the new ones. The Roman statesman Cicero once said, "The existence of many laws is the sign of a corrupt society." We cannot have the new nation choking in laws that will require some big, huge bureaucracy and police force to enforce. But I know this isn't really answering the question. I can answer it in spirit, at least, if not in micromanaged detail hot off the crystal ball. When asking about the Constitution and the law of the Northwest Republic, think backward. Think back to the days of the American frontier, the old Anglo-Saxons and the ancient Romans. In my personal opinion, real men settle their differences in person. They do not need a judge, and they damn sure don't need lawyers. I have often maintained that in this existing society, which is hag-ridden with lawyers, anyone who hires an attorney to attempt to do what he himself isn't man enough to do is a contemptible coward. Such a person is attempting to buy strength. He is attempting to hire the state's laws and judges and armed gunmen to do what he himself is too weak and fearful to attempt. He is attempting to hire the biggest bully on the playground, bribe him with candy apples and a flow of cash to beat up and terrorize his enemies when he himself isn't man enough to do so. This is one reason why we instituted the National Honor Court and the Dueling Code, so that white men can have access and recourse to the ultimate form of conflict resolution, and, in my opinion, the only one morally admissible after reasonable good faith community and individual efforts at mediation and arbitration fail. When that happens, when it becomes clear that a dispute is not subject to resolution by reason or consensus, then real men do not write checks to attorneys. They load up the flintlocks and break brave. And if they can't do it, if they're too chicken shit to put it all on the line for a principal or for someone that they care about, but the other party is, or if, to be fair, they honestly just don't believe that the cause is worth the risk and the possible bad outcome, then that itself tells the story as far as who deserves to win and who deserves to lose. In a way, it's like medieval trial by combat, and civil lawsuits, right or wrong, has almost never had anything to do with the issue. They're usually over money or over some weakling with no real case trying to use the law and the power of his money to hire attorneys in order to impose his will on others. The Northwest Dueling Code allows issues to be settled on the basis of strength of character and not on the basis of who can hire the best lawyer, who will offer the judge the juiciest bribe, or who can convince 12 idiots that one side or the other are telling the truth. Human nature being what it is, chances are that neither side is telling the truth. Okay, we'll get back to this topic in a bit, but right now I want to drop something in here real quick before I forget, and that's the second part of Bill White's April 2008 speech at the Hitler's birthday get-together in Chicago. So far as I know, Bill is still scheduled to go on trial in Roanoke, Virginia on Halloween Day for the ghastly and inhuman crime of sending his ex-wife an angry email about money 2 years ago. An email which, apparently, a government IT and computer expert has already informed the U.S. Attorney's Office White did not send and could not have sent, but the AUSA is going to try to avoid confusing the jury with facts. The complete lack of evidence, and indeed the contraindications from the dictatorship's own technical expert, leads me to believe that he's just going to get up in front of a jury half full of niggers and scream, "Nazi, Nazi, Nazi," and I have a horrible feeling that poor old Bill is toast, but let's all hope that I'm wrong about that. Anyway, here's Bill White, 6 months before the dictator's servants dragged him away to be brutalized and tortured.
This was covered up by a con. For 30 years, we've had a con, making us not see what has happened to us economically. The con has been the expansion of the credit system. As wages fell, more and more credit was provided, more and more opportunities to mortgage assets were provided, so white workers would continue to be able to make up that deficit. As their wages fell, they could borrow the difference between their current wages and what they were. And so we saw houses and businesses, middle class mortgaging their homes, the poor mortgaging their labor through a system of payments based on credit cards, even the government mortgaging the people of this country through inflation of their bond-based currencies. And who did we mortgage it to?
China.
Well, yes. Jews, foreigners, the owners of the international banking system, the financiers, the same financiers that played Herr Junker's Germany, the man with the big pockets, as I believe he put it, just as the farmers in this country were brought under the control of a handful of Jewish agricultural conglomerates, Jewish grain merchants, for lack of a better term, in the 1980s, and the newspapers and the banks were brought under the control of the Jews through their bankruptcy in the 1930s, they intend to put the entire American people under their direct control by their bankruptcy that they're bringing in this country now. Our role is to protect the white working class from the slavery of the Jew and their capitalist system. We must help white working people. We must shelter them during the collapse of this system. And we must lead them into a national socialist future. Without social constraint, the mercantile caste will enslave the people. We must rise up, seize control from this mercantile caste, and become that social constraint upon them. We know working people must work, but we must see to it that they work as free people in a system that serves their interests, that promotes them and their families, and does not fatten the pockets of a racially alien, exploitative elite. We must establish a white ruling caste above petty economic concerns, and we must regulate economic regulations for the benefit of the entire people. We understand, those of us here in this room, that we are not isolated individuals. We are not specks of dust swirling in a dust storm. We are each a small part of an organic racial whole. We are united in spirit, even more than in biology. We are one united soul in battle with all of the other organic racial entities that are out there. The men and women in this room are the defense of that racial body against the Jewish disease. Jews are the AIDS of white society. They came into our society attacking our immune system, racialism. They've sucked our energy, sucking away at our economy. They've allowed the diseases of Negro and mestizo barbarism to take hold, and they will end this infection by killing us all. We must look at the economic interests of our people. We must use the economic collapse to break working people from the slavery of the two-party system. And it's not as if the candidates have made it hard. Obama tells white people that they must not be bitter about the loss of their jobs and the pillaging of their economy. McCain said, "Your jobs are not coming back." These are both puppets of the billionaire capitalists that control this globalist system. Our two-party system is based not upon a real division in politics, but on a conflict between two elements of international communism. After the Jews seized control of Soviet Russia, there was a battle between Stalin and Trotsky. This carried over to their movement in America. The Stalinists became the multicultural wing of the Democratic Party. The Trotskyists embraced Zionism and became the movement we now know as neoconservatism. The Republican Party is as much a tool of these Jews as the Democrats. And we have seen, as we have been urged by certain leaders in the white nationalist movement, to attach ourselves to the radical wing of the Republican Party, that strategy means nothing but servitude to these same Jewish interests. We know outright that these liberals, these leftists, they attack us as white people. But these Jews that pretend to embrace us as white people are as much enemies of our struggle as the ones who are open about their hatred for us. We must break among white people the mentality that says there is no solution except by taking sides in this Jewish dichotomy and by compromising with one of these two political factions. I read an ADL press release that said today that we are gathered here to celebrate hate. We must never forget that our movement is not based on hate. We hate evil because we love good. And we build our movement on kindness and on love and on the interests of our white working class. We fight our enemies because they attack us. We fight them because we must defend our race. But we are here to develop our communities, promote our people, and lift our people up to their proper station. National Socialist Germany is the only nation to have solved the problem of Jewish global capitalism. From a deindustrialized, powerless, and bankrupt nation at the mercy of international finance, it created a workers' paradise on the basis of blood. It solved contradictions on the basis of race. It rebuilt a shattered economy, stabilized a broken currency, solved its ethnic struggle, and it is a model that a deindustrialized, bankrupt, and ethnically divided United States must follow. Our struggle is hard. We are beset by enemies, We face a powerful opposition and a powerful system. But we must fight and we must win because the alternative is too terrible to face. We fight or we are destroyed. For that reason, each of us must educate, must inform, and must lead our people into a brighter tomorrow and into a national socialist future. Heil Hitler!
Heil Hitler!
Heil Hitler! Heil victory!
Heil victory!
This is a British rock song a friend of ours pulled off the BNP website. I don't know the name of the group here, but it's about a young white man who was recently murdered by niggers in a hate crime attack in England. It's called 19 Years.
Just a boy of 19 years, he brought his joy, he brought his tears. 19 years, they go so fast, but the memories will last, will last. These prosperous times, these happy days, these lives to live, these changing ways. New generation, British youth, but soon we'd see the painful truth, the painful truth. 19 years that made the boy, 19 years his parents' joy, 19 years they stole away, 19 years lost in a day, lost in a day. And so it was that winter's night, wrong part of town they made him fight. Dark as the night and cold as steel, they cared not for the pain he'd feel, the pain he'd feel. And the boy fell to the ground, lying still he made no sound. All alone without a friend, 19 years came to an end, came to an end. And the blood it drained away unto the cold streets where he lay. And the rain came falling down unto this foreign part of town, this part of town. 19 years that made the boy, 19 years his parents' joy, 19 years they stole away, 19 years lost in a day, lost in a day. They said the murderers would pay, they said they'd put those men away. But years have gone and they're still free. There was no justice we could see, that we could see. The politicians looked away, they cannot who those people slay. 'Cause if you're white, your life is cheap, and all our people do is sleep, all they do is sleep. But Gavin Hopley will not die, we will keep on asking why. We'll keep his memory alive, and for his sake this land will thrive, this land will thrive. 19 years that made the boy, 19 years his parents' joy. 19 years they stole away. 19 years lost in a day. Lost in a day.
Okay, very quick current events comment. Now, I'm making this on Wednesday morning, and the news has just come in that the Republicans have surrendered in Congress, and they're basically about to give the dictator everything he wants. And the so-called conservative wing of the GOP is so disgusted they're talking third party, which fills the liberals with overweening joy, because that will split the white vote, and with their newly amnestied illegal alien voters, will ensure Democrat one-party rule for the next century. Except this clusterfuck won't last that long. Well, this was it, guys. The last chance that white people had for these spineless, whining Republican puppies in suits to use democracy to stand up to the dictatorship. Well, that's gone now. With that debt limit and the possibility of default, the cowards in the $5,000 suits might have given the system a push that would have brought down the temple like Samson on themselves as well as their enemies. But the little rich boy crybabies were whipped down into jelly by the media, who kept calling them names. Now, if that conservative third party movement does take shape, especially here in the Northwest, that will be a good opportunity for white nationalists as a whole and the Northwest nationalist movement in particular to do some stirring. But we'll get into that when the time comes. Right, now back to your comments on the Northwest Republic's Constitution. This is from John in Florida. Dear Harold, just reread the entire fourth edition white book and the proposed constitution. I don't see anything requiring modification except perhaps at the very beginning with the word Aryan. I suggest changing that to white, consistent with the 14 words. My reasoning is twofold. One, white people know that they're white, but don't have the slightest idea what the hell an Aryan is. Therefore, any public distribution of this document as propaganda may be rejected on page one. If they have any subconscious recognition of the term, it probably registers as a negative association. Two, it's way too easy for Zog to attack the term with their own propaganda. If a movement requires the support of the populace, then their concept of white would be unassailable, whereas Aryan would not immediately engender support, and meanwhile Zog would attack the hell out of it. I can easily imagine some of the efforts. Neo-Nazi, Hitler worshippers, skinheads, right-wing radicals, white supremacists, white separatists, homegrown terrorists, Holocaust deniers, all justified because the movement calls itself Aryan. Well, actually, John, you do know that that's pretty much what we are. Okay. As I've told you before, anything having to do with Hitler, Nazis, swastikas, SS runes, etc. is a non-starter in the American public's mind. The fact that so many whites were stupid enough to get Moncoid Obongo elected is proof. No way decades of Hitler gas 6 million Hebes can be erased, therefore any terms that allow an easy association with what every high school kid knows to be the quote-unquote truth cannot be overcome with mere NWF propaganda. Personally, I don't have any problem with the term Aryan because I figured out I was one when I was a teenager. Within the movement, fine, but for recruitment purposes, it may be counterproductive. Okay, John, I've gone over this before, but it's one of those hardy perennial questions that keeps popping up, and so let's take another run at it. Now, by and large, I agree with everything you're saying there, and that is one reason why I do use the term white instead of Aryan about 90% of the time. That is the reason why the Republic is called the Northwest American Republic and not the Northwest Aryan Republic, as some people wanted at the time when we put the Constitution together. I agree that the overwhelming majority of white people worldwide have no idea what Aryans are, or even that they are Aryans themselves. And when someone asks, I usually just tell them that Aryan is the German word for white man and leave it at that, and of course that's true as far as it goes. However, in a few places, I deliberately allow the use of the word Aryan for several rather subtle moral and practical reasons. For one thing, we as a collective movement, or tendency, or community, or whatever you want to call us, need to be a movement of truth, or at least grounded in truth so much as the tactical situation permits. And one of the areas where I think we need to remain at least within shouting distance of the truth is on the subject of who we are, our racial identity. Granted that we can't go around slinging certain terms and ideas into the air willy-nilly, especially National Socialist ideas, because these ideas and their terminology will trigger the Muggles' automatic mental rejection mechanisms, which have been socially engineered into them all their lives. That having been said, we need to make at least some effort in our propaganda and our quote-unquote conversation, as the liberals put it, to try and introduce certain ideas and terms as gently as we can, as subtly as we can. We need to give our own people food for thought. Maybe steer them to certain ideas and certain books and certain websites having to do with people like Commander Rockwell or Pastor Butler, where they can learn the truth for themselves if they are so inclined. And a lot of people are so inclined once they begin to wake up and they realize that they've been lied to all their lives. There is nothing like a newly awakened white man or woman who finally understands that they have been lied to all their life for wanting to learn the truth. They're like wolverines attacking anything with knowledge in it and devouring it. I've had copies of White Power and Which Way Western Man and Imperium literally ripped out of my hand by white people who were so eager to get at the knowledge and the truth that those books contain. Anything that will explain to them why they find themselves living in hell at age 40 or 42. One of our biggest problems, as I've said before, is the fact that it takes white people so long to learn wisdom. We have to wait for some kind of midlife crisis in their 40s before the scales fall from their eyes and they realize that they've been eaten by America. And not only do we need to make at least some effort to tell our own people the truth, but we need to start making that effort a lot younger than it's happening. We need to get at white kids in high school and maybe even junior high before the barnacles have completely encrusted their brain. Now, we not only need to occasionally drop that word Aryan into the conversation, but we need to start dropping it to teenagers and young adults. In fact, John, at the time, the committee did think about the use of the word Aryan in the preamble of the Northwest Constitution, and some spoke up for changing it to white, but I said it needed to stay, because this is a document for all the ages, John. Something that, in one form or another, our people will still be reading 1,000 years from now. And when they do, they need to read the truth, at least as much of it as will serve. Not something that's based entirely on the political and propaganda expediency of our own time. At some point, the process of deprogramming our own people and telling them the truth about who they are has to begin. And I can't think of any better place to begin that process than in the document which will become the basis of an entire new order of society on the earth. Okay, this is from Comrade Eric in Olympia, Washington, and it's another one of our hearty perennials. A question that pops up regularly, and which I generally deal with on this show about once a year, so I guess we're about due. Dear Mr. Covington, in last week's RFN, you solicited feedback on the NAR draft constitution. My only significant criticisms concern Section 4, Articles 4, 5, 6, and 9. For those of you who don't have your copy of the Constitution handy, by the way, those articles deal with the Bill of Rights, specifically the right to health care, adequate food, shelter and clothing, the right to gainful and productive employment, and the right to an education, including university and technical training, commensurate with someone's ability to learn. Okay, back to Eric's email. To me, these are entitlements, and I question whether codifying entitlements as absolute rights in a foundational document is wise or appropriate. How are such terms as adequate and life-preserving medical care and gainful and productive employment defined? How does the state guard against fostering dependency? How does the state guard against the dysgenic effects of proportionally investing in the least desirable elements of society generation after generation? What happens if the state cannot deliver on these promises for whatever reason or needs to revise or limit them somehow? Do these preclude or conflict with eugenic policy the state may pursue? Don't get me wrong, I think these concepts are worthy of consideration in an all-white society. However, aren't they best codified as mission statements or charters or policy goals and handled at the agency or ministerial level where they're subject to limitations, innovations, and or refinement? Just my 2 cents worth. Okay, Eric, let's take another run at this one. Now, I could easily spend a couple of programs on this topic, but I'm coming up to 50 minutes or so here, and so I need to find some way to distill this into something sharp, strong, and short. I run across this objection often, especially in our European comrades from Sweden and the UK, this absolute revulsion over anything even remotely suggestive of a Marxist socialist welfare state from people who have lived in welfare states all their lives. In this country, the situation is even more stark than it is in Europe. For 6 decades or so now, we have had a welfare situation in America which is based on the principle of taking money away from white people who worked for it and earned it, and giving it to black and brown people who did not. Now, I can understand why Americans are infuriated and outraged by even the suggestion of a welfare state of any kind. We've all been robbed for too long. Now, the first thing you need to bear in mind is that the modern-day welfare state issue in the white Western world, but especially in the United States, is based on race. Everything in American history, is based on race. Race is the American issue and has been since 1492, as formulated in the simple question, who does the continent of North America belong to? Race, race, race. Everything in America is always about race, and always has been. In the American context, the present welfare state question we live with today is racial in nature. But we are not talking about taking money away from white people to give it to niggers. We're talking about the kind of future society that we want our all-white nation to be. And you ask why that these guarantees need to be in the Constitution instead of just agency regulations or laws by the National Convention, so forth and so on. Because in an all-white society, a society where everyone contributes, a folkish community, if you will, these things should indeed be basic rights. They should indeed be part of what the state's role in society is. I know I'm expressing that a little clumsily, but do you understand the difference in the entire nature of the question, Eric? What's the difference between this toilet we live in now and a racially homogenous, all-white world of the future is factored in? You can't even frame the question in the same way. It's apples and oranges. Okay, I could go off on the same ramble I did last time I addressed this topic, but this time I think I'll take an Iron Chancellor fascist line and just make the following assertions, which I really don't think are arguable if you've ever read Plato's Republic. The dynamics of a welfare state, which apply in multiracial societies, where the black and brown races basically get on the white man's back and ride, do not apply to an all-white society such as the Northwest American Republic will be. In order to fulfill its function as a homeland for all our people, and to survive in a hostile and indeed genocidal world, the Northwest American Republic will have certain overriding interests that it must protect and maintain. We won't even call them rights here. Call them interests of the state. It is in the overriding interest of the state that the all-white population of the Northwest Republic be maintained in a high state of health and medical well-being, especially children. Sick and malnourished kids don't make for very good soldiers for when the Americans finally come for us. It is in the overriding interest of the state that the all-white population of the Northwest Republic be gainfully employed in economically and socially productive labor. One of the worst situations that can exist in any society is large numbers of unemployed young men hanging around on street corners. Ask the Muslims. It is in the overriding interest of the state that the Northwest Republic have a young, white, racially homogenous population and workforce that is educated and trained to the highest standards possible in every field of human endeavor, from engineering and architecture and biochemistry to the arts and academic disciplines to the science of politics and statecraft. Now, as to how we avoid the creation of a white welfare underclass, which most certainly does exist in Europe, and which I've seen in Britain and Ireland myself, including third and fourth generation welfare mothers, and indeed whole welfare families. Now, there are several preventative provisions for this in the Constitution. First off, I'm not sure where this is specifically laid out in the Constitution. It seems to me it is somewhere, but if not, the Constitutional Convention needs to make sure it is, and I know it's in the Northwest novels. Anyway, the purpose of the National Labor Service is not only to get certain necessary key tasks within society, such as hauling garbage and digging ditches, done, but to act as the economic safety net against the perils of capitalism. And in an all-white society, that is something the state damn well needs to do. Remember, George Bernard Shaw once said, "The state should provide the people equal protection against the burglar and against the banker." That's what the Northwest Republic will have to do. By the way, just in case you guys think I got my way on all things with this Constitution, I personally was in favor of banning all private banks in the Northwest Republic and just having one run by the state. But that was a bit too socialistic for some of the other people on the committee, so I lost out on that one. But anyway, when a citizen or resident of the Northwest Republic finds himself unemployed, he or she does not get a welfare check of cash. The state gives him or her a job within the labor service until the economy picks up again and they can go back to the private sector, which is admittedly where most employment belongs. Okay, it may or may not be much of a job, depending on each individual situation or what the economy's like at the time. It may only be picking up trash and cigarette butts in the park or painting fire hydrants for 8 hours a day, but those jobs need to be done by somebody. People will be coming into work every day, putting on their labor service coveralls and going out and doing something for which they will be paid. They will not just be sitting at home watching the TV and collecting a welfare check from the mailbox every month. Now, if you're worried about a dependent underclass developing, Eric, don't be. One of the main operating principles of Northwest society is that no one just sits around doing nothing and drawing a check off the taxpayer. If for no other reason, then frankly, we're not going to be able to afford it. With no income tax and no tax on residential homestead property, we're just not going to have the money to maintain a large underclass like democracy does. And since we won't be in a position to borrow huge amounts of money from international banks like the democracies are, we're just not going to have the money to do things the old way. Okay, I tell you what, I think we need to juice up our mellows for this episode. This is the Tannehill Weavers.
Thank you.
Right. I just checked the net, and it is confirmed that the Republicans in the House are surrendering, and the dictator has been given everything he wants. Limitless borrowing, limitless spending, not even a hint of doing anything about the horror of Obamacare.
Surprise, surprise, Sergeant Carter.
Not that there was much that could have been accomplished using democracy, but if the Republicans in the House of Representatives had managed to keep their spines stiff, they could at least have forced the dictator to rip off the mask of law completely and rule as a dictator openly, borrowing what he wants, printing money when he wants. At least the GOP would have gone down fighting by their lights. Well, that's it then. The party of Abraham Lincoln is done. It died not with a bang, not even with a whimper, but with a fart. They have handed the country over to a baby shit brown Muslim mulatto and a ghetto hoe and a gang of criminals called the Democrat Party, who will rule forever and ever and ever, or so they think. Sic transit gloria mundi. From now on, it's only downward. I suspect there may not even be any more stabilizations at a lower and lower level of the kind that have marked the society's gradual deterioration over the last 60 years. Now that the dictator can borrow, print, and spend whatever the hell he wants without any regulation or supervision whatsoever, and now that he has that Jewish Janet Yellen in place at the Federal Reserve to load him up with all the cash he wants, he will go on an orgy of spending like a drunken sailor. Ever heard the phrase nigger rich? That's going to be Obongo for the next year or so. Then, at some point in time, the bottom will fall out. Possibly when the Chinese demand that their T-bills and bonds be repaid. Possibly when the oil-producing companies switch to the euro instead of the dollar. Who knows? I won't predict how and when and how bad, because there are now so many possibilities as to how this regime could go down, it's impossible to guess. Look, do I even need to say it? How safe do you really think you are where you're living now? How surrounded are you by blacks and browns and American scum? What are your local police like? Will they still make an attempt to protect you even after they're no longer being paid? Or will the niggers and the Mexicans among them turn predator and start robbing and killing and raping like the so-called police in Haiti and Nicaragua? What's it going to take to get you to come home, white boy? Just how goddamn stupid are you? When, boy, when? When is the little light bulb going to come on over your head? When are you going to look around you and see all those black and brown faces and hear all that negroid booga 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 and the chattering Spanish in the stores and on the street? When are you going to force yourself to think about what your present place of residence is going to be like in a few years' time, when the real world finally catches up to this nigger dictator we've got and all his little Jewish friends? Well, our time is up, and so is yours if you have sense enough to realize it. So that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.